Welcome to Hope Talks, where we share inspiring stories of hope in Jesus Christ. Hope Talks is hosted by Pastor Margaret Michael and Grayson Willis. Join us for uplifting stories of triumph, faith, and the enduring power of Christ's love. Also, if you're in the listening area, tune in to 1470 AM or 102.1 FM WBTX to listen to Hope Talks every Sunday at noon.
Welcome to today's broadcast of Hope Talks. I'm Grayson Willis. Thanks for tuning in. Today we will be airing part two of Dwayne Martin's testimony. If you missed part one last Sunday, you can visit our website, cotnaz.org, click Watch Listen, and click Hope Talks. May God bless.
We got our first placement and really enjoyed it. You know, my wife was in nursing school at the time, so I had a lot of time with the kids myself, and really enjoyed it. And we went on to foster 17 children over 12 years, wow. A couple that we had long term. I think the longest we had was 3 years, the young lady that was with us for a little over 3 years. And we did what they call specialized foster care. So these were children that needed specialized care. They wouldn't go into the regular foster care system. Mm. You know, so DSS or CPS would pick the children up. And then because of their needs, they would go to specialized foster care. So not only do we get into foster care, we said, let's get into foster care plus.
You know, so. Go big or go home.
Right? That's right. Home. Well, you'd had lots of, yeah. You had lots of experience. So why not kick it up a notch?
Yeah, stick with what we know.
Oh, that's great. It's amazing, like, the things that we, and I say we, because I don't know if I didn't have the same experience with other children in our home, but sometimes was rebellious against the life, you know, that conservative life. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how, just to hear you talk about the process of no, well, maybe, well, no, but then, you know, like, isn't God gracious to give us that time and help you get to that point of, okay, you have a wife now that wants to do it. Mm-hmm. She goes to a training, which reminds me of Rhonda when she took her husband on a date and ended up at a training. But just that, the gentleness of that and how God slowly prepared your heart and then brought this guy along to have conversations. And I can't imagine what your parents' joy was when they found out that you were going to be doing this.
Yeah. Their joy came out of a little bit of I told you so. You know? All five of the biological kids, all five of us were all foster parents. And my sister Diane and I were the only two that didn't adopt. The other my three older siblings, Debbie, Donnie, Darla, we're all with these. It's Debbie, Donnie, Darla, Dan, Dwayne. So the older three all adopted children. My one sister, Debbie, the oldest, I believe she adopted four, she and her husband. And then my brother Donnie, he adopted two. And my sister Darla, who lives in Florida, they adopted one. Fostered many, but they all went into adoption.
So you're talking about you have children. You had concerns about bringing other children in. And what if somebody's listening right now and they've thought about it, but they're in the same place? What would you say to them? I know the Lord works it out. If he calls you to it, he'll get you through it, right? But what was the impact on your children? And it turned out being different from what you thought it would be.
Yeah, remarkably different. We had two boys in particular that came to live with us, and I'll skip their names. We'll just call them two young boys for now. And they were, at the time, they were 13 and 8. And they came from a standard background. You know, mom needed some help. She needed to work on some rehab things, and the children were taken by CPS. And they came to our house, and I'll never forget when they came, our daughter had just started walking, and she had a little toy knife. And the two boys walked in, and the oldest one, she walked right up and stabbed him with it, you know. And that was just our daughter. She was a very precocious little girl. And that wasn't a bad interaction. That was just her introduction. And that action ended up just utterly endearing her to the older boy and he to her. He just took her within 24 hours. She was his baby sister. You know, and those two, out of all the placements we had some great placements. I'm just focusing on these two for now. We only had them for 1 year. Mm-hmm. That's all they were with us before they went back home. And their mother did remarkable. She did what she was supposed to do. She got herself back on track. And so their going home was a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. They had some challenges, challenges, but they went home. And that's the whole intent of foster care. Mm-hmm. We want to rehabilitate, help parents rehabilitate so they can take their children back again. Yeah. Sometimes it's easy to forget that one. especially when you put the emotional side into it, you fall in love with these kids. And some of them, the best day is the day they go home too. You know, we had some challenging kids that were like, oh, man, we made it through that one. But these two young boys, they were just dear to us, and they fit into our family just a hand in a glove. We went on family vacations the summer we had them. I was building homes at the time, so they would go to work with me after school. I'd pick them up, and they'd come to the job sites, and we'd work together. And mm-hmm. we did. That winter was particularly cold and snowy, so we had a lot of days where we weren't working. And my wife is a nurse, so she was at work. So the four kids and dad, we'd go fishing every time. Mm-hmm. You know, so we went around different creeks and caught trout and just had a remarkable year. And we have a pond on the farm we live on. We live adjacent to my father-in-law's farm. And there's a pond on the farm that the boys just loved. And every chance they got, they were straight out the house and straight down to the farm and fishing and adventure and eating birds they managed to get with BB guns. Yeah. That didn't hurt them. They were fine. You know, but the watch all four of the children down there just being together like a group of siblings was remarkable. And when I say those two boys fit into our family like a hand in a glove, it was beautiful and we loved it. And when they went home, I remember that evening, my wife and I sitting with Gavin and Kaylin in the living room, and we were playing a game because we all four just felt lost. And I remember thinking, like, this is a deal breaker. And I was thinking just I statements. I was like, I can't do this. You know, just seeing them go home. And at the time, we didn't know that her mother was going to do this as well as she did. You know, there's all the unknowns. And when they go home, you'd never know any of that. Well, fast forward a few weeks, it was a very, very cold February night. We get a call from a neighbor who didn't know that they had been sent back to their mother, which was a plan. They said, hey, I just picked up a young man walking along Route 42, and he said he was going home to your house. Well, this was the older of the two boys. He had walked all the way from the trailer court they lived on the south end of Harrisonburg to our house. That's a long walk. And he had made it all the way across Harrisonburg, all the way down Route 42, and was very close to the road we live on. And the neighbor saw him walking because he was in a T-shirt and picked him up and brought him. And so he brought him back to our house. And, of course, I made phone calls immediately, mm-hmm. you know, to the proper individuals, the foster care agency. And we actually let the sheriff's department know. And then they called his mother and said, he's here. And he said, I just want to be here. I just want to be here. Now, this is a 13-year-old young man. And he said it like this at 13. He said, I was stable here. So he had the resentments to his mom that he had been taken, and he was going through his own things. And what a heart-wrenching moment to know that we have to send you back. Like, folks are going to come and you have to go home. Well, the beauty of that is this never happens in foster care. Through that event, we got to know his grandfather, who is just a stand-up, salt-of-the-earth good man. And he said, man, he said, you guys should come over for dinner to his mom's house. And the grandparents are there, so we jumped right on it. We all went and had dinner together. Yeah. And that turned into us having the boys pretty much every other weekend. They came to our house often during the summertime, and we got to maintain a family and their family, integrate with our family. We became just a bigger family. Both those boys went off to serve in the military. We got invited to the older one. We got to go to his boot camp graduation, and his mother and grandparents invited us to sit in the parent section. You know, so when the graduation was done, the kids came to their parents, and the oldest one posted a picture on Facebook. And it was him sitting in his uniform right after post-graduation. And he had his arm around me. It just said, me and my dad.
Wow.
That was a huge moment. Yeah. I mean, it almost made, I am not an emotional person, you know. Yeah. But talking about these kids tends to bring it out of me, I guess. But it was just a huge moment. And that was just two of the placements. We also had a young lady that came to live with us that we had for over 3 years. And just to see her transformation from the day that she came, she had been starved before she came to us, and she was just a twig. Just this tiny little girl because she was so thin. And when she first came, she would pour hair out. We had one night we heard some noise in the pantry, and we went and looked, and she was sitting in the pantry eating a box of dry cereal. And just because she had been starved and not used to eating. And so it took us a while to get her acclimated to, like, hey, no, we actually have breakfast, lunch, and dinner here. This is a normal, safe environment. And she was with us for a couple of years. Actually lives local again now. We get to see her from time to time. I get to watch some of her boys' baseball games, you know, and she's a phenomenal young mom, doing a wonderful job. We had a little girl that came to us one day, didn't speak a drop of English, not a drop. But she was not with us long, maybe just a couple months. But she ended up going to Pennsylvania with me to visit my parents. And I learned what baño means, if I'm even saying that right. She kept saying that. I was like, I don't know what that means. And then we had an accident in the car, so we had to.
You learned real quick what that meant.
That's a word I know now. So, but she was such a doll. And she looked at the bathtub just mesmerized that water was coming out of the wall. We had no history in this young girl whatsoever. And we learned bits and pieces later, but it explained why everything just amazed her. We sat down to eat one day and she was eating with her hands. And it wasn't because she had learning disabilities. She wasn't on the spectrum anywhere. She just
had never had that.
Yeah, they were fresh off the boat. This is all new stuff to her. And I fell in love with that little girl. We did not communicate languages at all. We had a friend of ours come over that spoke Spanish, coming out that she didn't really speak Spanish. Spanish was the little girl's second language. She ended up being, I might be butchering this name a bit, but she was Mestaco Indian.
Okay.
So she had a whole other language that nobody around here could speak, but she understood enough Spanish that our friend could communicate with her a little bit. But something about this little girl, she had me wrapped around her finger. She was such a little doll. And my wife called me at work one day and said, she's gone. They came and picked her up.
Mm.
And again, I'm like, I'm done. I'm not doing this. My wife, doing all these years with the foster kids, she was just that solid mom that these kids needed. Mm. And she had a way of handling those situations far better than I did. You know, she would just, she would categorize things, say, we have them now. We're going to do the best we can while we have them. We're going to lead, teach, and instruct. And then they'll go home. And that's how it's supposed to be. We were not an adoptive family. So she actually, I think she towed me through a lot of the situations.
Sounds like she was the person. That's just ordained, an ordained marriage and calling for you all together.
Yeah, just that solid mother figure.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, so through all these experiences, how did you get involved with the Isaiah House, the Isaiah 117 House?
So fast forwarding again. If I can back up just for a second, during those years when I was not going to be a foster parent, we weren't going to be foster parents and we weren't going to have kids and we weren't going to do this. I went back to school and got a degree in psychology and went to work for Children's Services of Virginia. I worked on the counseling. I worked on the counseling side for 11 years, you know, so I couldn't have been more engrossed into the system at that point. And I was all in for almost 11 years. I worked with wonderful people. And being on the counseling side, I had nothing to do with any removals or anything like that. But I just worked with the kids outside of that in the counseling side.
The Isaiah 117 House, how did you get? I know that you work for Harmon Construction, so that's part of your connection. But just, I don't think it's coincidence that you're leading this project with all the experience that you have, both directly and kind of secondhand and all these areas. So,
you know, it's everything keeps coming full circle. We talked about that a little bit downstairs. Whenever you say no, and if it is your calling, if it is what your life is meant to be, it's going to come back around. You can fight it for so long, but it's going to come back around. After being a foster parent for all those years, I went back to work in the foster care in the Children's Services of Virginia, and we had one foster child while I worked there for a while. And then we decided when our children got a little older and they needed some more one-on-one attention from us, we did decide, my wife and I collectively, that we were going to go ahead and pause. We never said we were going to stop. We ended up not doing it anymore, but we decided we were going to pause, focus on Gavin and Kaylin, and which we did. And I think that was the right decision at the time. I thought, well, I'm done with this then. You know, this chapter's over. We're moving on to something different. So then I ended up working there for almost 11 years. And after 11 years, the center got sold. Sam sold the business to his daughter, actually, that ended up taking the reins of it. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep the position I was in, I would have had to work on an advanced degree. I stopped with a bachelor's degree. I went one semester in graduate school and just made a financial decision that I couldn't afford to continue with that degree just based on what the field paid and what the degree would cost. And it was a difficult decision, but you know, I did decide, okay, I'm just going to stay with what I have. Well, then as the new ownership took over and things were changing, as they do when things change, in order to keep the position I was in, program administrator, I would have had to work on my advanced degree and get the credentialing that they wanted for that position. And, you know, Sam put me in the position I was in, and I would look back and think, man, he was crazy. I wasn't ready for that. But, you know, he was a man that was such an encourager that if he saw something in you, he was going to push you to that point. And there was a lady that worked there, Denise Janoka, that was just ended up being this absolute wonderful mentor to me in the counseling world, you know, just to really push me to even finish my bachelor's degree. But we did all that. Worked there at the center. I ended up leaving. Then the center actually shut down, unfortunately, during COVID. They pulled the plug on the whole program, so Crossroads Counseling is no more. It was an arm of Children's Services. So I thought I was totally done. Like, okay, that chapter of my life is closed. And I started working at Harmon Construction. Wonderful company, fit in great, love the people I work with. And I'm chugging along. Life is good, you know. I volunteer with some veteran groups and work with guys with some veterans with some issues. So still using the counseling thing. But the whole children part of it was kind of done. And I was at Rotary one morning, and our typical Tuesday morning meeting, we had a speaker come in. It was this young lady named Jenny Butcher, and she came in and she gave her story, and it was actually her with Ashley Bellamy. They came in and Jenny said her story, and Ashley talked about the Isaiah House. And I sat there and found myself just leaning in, like, you do what? This is, you do. I was like, this is my parents' house. You know, such a large degree, this is what my parents would do. During the end of the crack epidemic, my parents started taking babies in that were addicted to crack. And they had one little girl that came that she was not on death's door, but if she died, it wouldn't have been a shock. I mean, she was born addicted to drugs. And I remember my mom and dad just taking turns, just rocking this little girl and rocking her. And she's now 30 years old with two children. She survived. Wow. And I think she survived for nothing more because of the love of my parents. But I'm listening to Ashley talk about the Isaiah House. I'm like, okay. And it had been a long time since I heard any nonprofit that just drew me in like that said, yeah, it's not even a question. Something has to be done. And they were talking about the goals in the area. And the initial goal was to need board members. And I ended up talking to Ashley like, hey, you know, I might do this. This is really interesting. Then I learned about the house. But fast forward a few more weeks, I came here, actually, to the Church of Nazarene. And Ashley was here. She, if you know Ashley, she's a ball of energy.
Yes, she is. Oh,
she is.
For sure.
Yeah. Very driven lady. Yeah. And then Jenny gave her story, and then the founder of Isaiah House gave hers. And I'm a construction worker. I have a beard. I wear flannel. I don't cry in front of people. And I had to walk out to your lobby because I started thinking about Jason. Mm. I started thinking about the sacrifice that my parents made. You know, they were not wealthy people by any stretch of the imagination. Children were their mission in life. And a lot of the resentments I had, it took me to become an adult with my own life experiences, look back at the sacrifice they made. And I was like, man, I need to be a part of this. And yeah, I had to go out in your lobby. I went to the bathroom. My eyes were leaking. I didn't, need to do something so nobody saw this. I wouldn't want to be a tough guy. But when I sat back down, I said, okay, God, where do I fit in this? And then the house came up. I was like, I'm a contractor. I worked for a contractor. I was my own for a long time. I thought, okay, what can we do to build this house? Well, then they had a very reasonable budget to build the house. But then they made a statement, every dollar we save simply gets put towards the next house. Well, then naturally, we should be able to do this house for nothing. You know, let's set the bar pretty high. And, you know, we're not going to be able to do it for nothing, but that's right. Where the bar was set. But I went back to Harmon Construction and said, hey, they're going to be building this new Isaiah 117 house. And the resounding questions were, what's Isaiah 117? Ooh, let me tell you about something I can speak passionately about, even though I don't know much about it beyond these meetings. But we were talking about other work, and Harmon dedicates a project every year to charitable work. So it wasn't a stretch at all to do something with the Isaiah House. That was not a stretch at all, but I was pushing hard. I wanted to do something big, like let's do something big here. And our director of operations, Gary McBride, he was here and listened to some of that too. Yeah. And I had no idea that he was just like, yes. And this is a man of few words.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, outstanding man. I love him to death. But in my 8.5 years at Harmon, I never saw him be animated like this. And he was like, yeah, we're going to do this. So we started talking to the management, which he's part of the management team at Harmon. And it just fell into place. Boom, 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 boom. And I'm saying, hey, we're going to volunteer. Let's be the GC of record and project manage it and to get this thing to go up. And with Gary's influence in the construction community, we literally had people calling the office saying, I want to be a part of this. I want to help with this. You know, and we now have the first floor of that house framed. And I know that we're not at $35,000 in billing yet. Mm. The amount of contractors that have come out and hearing their stories, just like it was much, much less dangerous than the New York City subways. Yeah. These are guys in the valley. But, you know, the first excavating company that come out to do the footings on the house, I asked him, you know, what the cost would be to get a takeoff on the amount. And he said, man, my little girl's adopted. I'm not charging anything.
Wow.
So they come out and did all the footing, get all the footings prepped and dug and prepped. And because he adopted a little girl, you know, Momentum Earthworks come out and they're just like, yeah, we'll put your construction interest in. Okay, how much? Don't worry about it. You know, we need a stone called Fraser Quarry. Don't worry about it. You know, it's just going. Two Brothers Plumbing locally, I was looking for a plumbing contractor for it and got chatting with them. And they would say, well, we want to hear more about this project and what it is. Like, what is this place? I explain it to them. I get their takeoff. Nothing.
Wow.
They volunteered everything, parts, materials. A local plumbing company jumped in and donated all the pipe, all the fixtures. Electric company out of Charlottesville contacted me through LinkedIn and said, we want to be a part of this. They donated all the wire, the panel box, all the light fixtures per the drawings, everything. You know, and so to see a community come together, this is a powerful, powerful program. Mm-hmm. And the way it touches people amazes me. And people, what I'm seeing, people are not doing this so they feel good about themselves. Right. People, by and large, believe in the mission of helping children.
Right. Yes.
And I was out at the Isaiah House last week one day when framing was just getting ready to start. And we had a bunch of materials delivered and stacked up. And I was just kind of walking around by myself. And the concrete guys had just left. And I'd watched them wrap things up. And I just started thinking about it. And I was saying little prayers, you know, just like, this is amazing. Like, the momentum this has, I want to see this keep going. And it's Ashley called me one day and said, I can't believe what you're doing out here. It's so amazing. It's not me, Ashley. I'm literally not selling anybody on this. They're coming to us.
Yeah.
And I was walking around the project thinking, man, I want to keep my focus as it's exciting to see all the donations. It's exciting to see it go up. The blessings are incredible. But I want to bring that focus back to saying, this is for these little children.
That's right.
To have a safe spot to be, and you can plant that seed. One of the foster boys that we had, we didn't have him very long at all. And he ended up in the United States military as well, but we had him a very short period of time. And when he was serving over in Afghanistan, he called me through Facebook Messenger, actually. And they were in a very tense situation. There was fighting. I could actually hear some, what I later learned was indeed gunfire in the background. And apparently he was not allowed to do what he did, you know, but he wasn't sure he was going to get out of the situation he was in. And he called me and he said, I love you, Dad. We did not have this young man long at all. We did not have him with us long. But I was reminded of that when I was walking around the Isaiah House. That's just that moment in time.
Yeah.
You know, that moment in time that may seem insignificant to you in the grand scheme of things to a child can be the transformational moment in their life.
Yes.
You know, so if we can have a place like the Isaiah House that is safe, that these children can come to, albeit for 24 hours, and just have stable individuals, a stable environment. They may be passing through and people say, well, I got to help this week. I got to help a child. And you forget about it. May not even remember their names after a while. I can't honestly remember all the names of the children that we had in foster care with my wife and I or my parents. But it's that moment in time that means so much more to these children than it does to us. And they may not realize that till they're a whole lot older, but you start to, like we talked about earlier, like, you know, what's an influential moment in your history? I can go back to that moment with Mr. Dean. You know, this man that owed me nothing in this world. He just loved kids.
Yeah.
You know, he's
yeah.
a single man, never married, taught his whole life. And when he passed away, the funeral was, it was held at Gardens by High School in the auditorium, named after him, the Standing Auditorium. They said, I wasn't there for it. I had to miss it. But they said it was standing room only. Like they said, and it flowed out into the parking lot. That's an enormous crowd. But it was that moment in time where he was there for all these people. You don't affect people like that unless your spirit is right, unless your heart is right.
That's right.
You know, when your heart is right, you're not doing it for your glory. You're not doing it for anything for yourself. You're simply doing it because you love kids.
That's right.
And you want to see the best life you can for them. Unfortunately, if you look at stats in foster care, it's a really, really high failure rate. And I don't know the statistic offhand, but I used to, but incredibly high failure rate. Mm-hmm. But there's a reason why Jesus left the 99 for one.
That's right. Yeah.
You keep trying.
That's right. It is. It's not about getting people to, or those kids to respond in a certain way or get them to do a certain thing, but it's just about being present with them.
Yeah. And they might yell at you, curse at you, you, bite you.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it's working to us. You know? But that child may look back to that moment in time and said they stayed.
Yeah. 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 We had a girl that stayed with us. It wasn't through foster care, but may as well have been. From the time she was 3 until she was about 7, and off and on, not with us all the time, but we're kind of respite care for a nanny that had been hired to take care of her. And she comes and spends the weekend with us. She's just started at the University of Maryland this month, and she came and spent the weekend before she went back to school. And it's just, if every person, and it's not all the same calling, right? We all have a different calling, but it is being present with the people that we're with. And what's the saying about being the world to
do for one what you wish you could do for
the world,
everybody?
Yeah. Do for one what you wish you could do for everybody.
When I was in New York City, Michael Banks had a saying, and it was very simple: each one teach one, and soon the whole world will know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, our pastor, we're about the one here, and I love that. It's what Jesus did,
yeah.
right? It's what he did, and he's given us a great model. He's let us know how he feels about little children.
Yeah. They're pretty important.
It's pretty important.
Unless you become as a little child, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, and he has some things to say about if you're not nice to kids, too.
You know, and if you listen to children, which we all do, but there's a saying in counseling that you listen with the intent to understand, not respond.
Right.
And if you really keep that in mind, it's amazing when you're meeting people how much of their story you'll hear. When you really just give them your full undivided attention, people love to tell you their stories, and they will. But when you listen to children talk, the stories that come out are sometimes just absolutely cute. And sometimes there's just such incredible depth and truth in the honesty they're saying because they don't know to lie. This past weekend, my wife and I were in Kentucky. A very close friend of ours passed away very young back on June 29th. And this past weekend, my wife and I drove down to his wife and their children just to spend a weekend with them. And he has a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old and just absolutely adorable kids. And this little girl at the breakfast, she's 3 years old, very articulate 3-year-old. But her mom said, would you like to say the blessing? So she did. And she started the prayer, which I know her dad, so I knew where it came from. But you want to talk about falling apart at breakfast, trying to hold it together. She said, Dear Heavenly Father. I mean, what 3-year-old starts their prayers out with that? So she went through all the regular, thank you for this day. Thank you for our breakfast. Thank you for Denise. And then her mom whispered to her, and she said, and Dwayne. And then she said, I'm so sad that you took Daddy away, but I'm glad that he's in heaven. I hope he's okay.
Wow.
Try to eat breakfast after that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the simplicity of that prayer and just the raw honesty in that prayer is what we're all called to be at. I mean, if we pray in front of people, do we not write it down sometimes so we get it right? You know,
right.
We bring it to the front of the congregation so we can, and it's fine. That's fine. Yeah. I'm just talking about that raw.
Praying from your heart.
Yeah. Like, here it is, God. I'm saying it. I was on a beach in Hawaii volunteering a few years ago, and there was a young man that was there that had lost his brother to a motorcycle accident, and he was a missionary there in Kona. So he came along on the short-term missions trip to see where his brother lived, and we were on the beach, and he's from a very plain Mennonite family. We went for a walk one night. He just kind of randomly asked me, he said, can we go for a walk? And I didn't know his name yet, but I knew he had lost his brother. My cousin that I was with had told me that. So we went for a walk on the beach. And I could just feel his pent-up rage when he was thinking about, you know, how do I process the loss of my brother? They were very close, and he was only in his early 20s. And we were walking on the beach, and I was like, I said, what are you thinking right now? Like, what's the most just dark thought you have right now? Like, that's down in the pit of your stomach. That's just eating at you. And he's like, swear words. And I was like, well, let's say them. And he's looked at me. Now, as you and I know from the Mennonite community, this is frowned upon. But he was very uncomfortable with it, and we got to the meat of it. I was like, you know, these things that are down inside you like that, I said, you need to tell God exactly what's on your mind and your heart, and he'll take it, wants it. And until you let it out, he's waiting.
Yeah, and you're going to be miserable until you do, right?
Yeah.
I say, you know, God already knows. He just wants you to be honest enough with him to say it. And he's big enough to take it, right?
Oh, and he wants it.
And he wants it.
And he knows anyway, so we might as well tell him.
Yeah, let it out.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, so if someone is listening today and they go, I have something that I would like to do to help with the house, how can they get a hold of you?
So they can reach me at my email address, and that's dmartin@harmonconstruction.com. And they can also call our number, which is 540-434-4459, extension 103. That's me at Harmon. They can call either one of those numbers to get a hold of me directly. They can also ask for Gary McBride.
And
they can also contact Jenny Butcher through the Isaiah House. If you have a straight financial donation, Jenny Butcher would be their best point of contact. If you do contact me, I'll make sure you get in the right spot. If you have a particular construction trade that you would like to come and contribute to the house, and that can be anything from if we're going to need people to rake dirt to plant grass.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be as skilled in the trades. If you have a strong back and a weak mind, we have somewhere for you.
I love it. That is great. That's good. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us. We may have to have you back and get an update and some more stories.
Dwayne, it's been great to have you today. And thank you for joining us to share your story and also about the work you're doing with the Isaiah 117 house.
You're welcome. Looking forward to seeing the house get completed and more houses go up.
Yep. Thank you for listening to today's broadcast of Hope Talks. We pray that as we've talked with Dwayne Martin today about his story and about the work he's doing with the Isaiah 117 House, that it truly has been a half hour of hope for your life. May God bless.
Hope Talks is sponsored by Church of the Nazarene in Harrisonburg in partnership with Sunshine Ministries. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcast. Your feedback helps us spread hope to even more listeners. Stay tuned for more uplifting stories in the next episode. Until then, keep the faith, share the love, and find joy in the hope that Jesus Christ brings.